Danny, all right, please. I am getting Spider. I am getting it for you. If you care to wait for just one nanosecond, I might just be able to... Leanne? 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 Did you see where she went? Danny, did you see where your sister went? Stop that. Stop that now. Listen to me. There are a lot of people here. Did you see where your sister went? Leanne? Leanne! Excuse me, excuse me. Did you see a little girl? She was here just a minute ago, a little girl. No, no, no. She was just standing here, right here. We were just getting shoes and we came out and I turned to get the toy out for him because he was being, and I couldn't find it, so I was looking and I turned and she was not there. She was not... Yeah, my daughter. It's my daughter. Have you seen... She's 7. She's got red hair. She's wearing a blue top and short. She was here. She was right here. And Leanne! Leanne! What? I don't know. Should we call? You think we should... Danny, stop that. Should we call them? Do you think we should... Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, no, 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 no. I don't believe this. This is not, this isn't, I mean, this can't be... Leanne! Leanne! Oh, Jesus. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. Please, Leanne. Please, please, please help me. Please, she's... Leanne! What? Where? Oh, my God. 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 Don't you ever do that again, okay? Don't you ever, ever do that again. Do you hear me? Listen to me. You listen to me. Don't you ever do that again. It is dangerous. There are thousands of people here. I'm like, no. No, I want her to be scared. She needs to hear this. She should cry. You could have been... Someone could have... No, no, I'm fine. Thank you. I'm just... Okay, I've got you. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I've got you now. I'll never let you go. It's much harder to kill a human being than you think. And oddly, it's also much easier as well. Someone I went to school with was killed by a tennis ball. A woman in Canada died choking on a marshmallow. The real trick, though, is not the physical doing, it's the mental doing. The real trick is that you have to put yourself outside all this, into a place where the people, the ideas, the conversations, morality, and the family connections you've nurtured for years no longer matter. And once you have put yourself past those things, once you do that... So as I'm going home, my first thought about this whole infidelity was, oh... Okay. Which surprised me. I did not expect to be so calm, and I was even slightly impressed with myself, like, look at me, so cool. And at home that evening, I was irritated, yes, but with a slight smirk in it, like, oh, so that's it, is it? That's what this whole thing's been about, your need to fuck something new, well done. But then just before I fell asleep, this sort of colour of hurt bled into that. It just crept up on me, this pain. And oddly, when sentences formed in my mind, like, I wonder how tall she is, I would hear them in my head and it would surprise me by being utterly agonizing. The next morning, I woke to find that this had multiplied in my sleep and had transformed into a burning, ferocious, white-hot anger that was so intense I could actually feel my skin sizzling. I didn't say anything. Not for a good 5 or 6 weeks. I needed to get my head straight, form a plan. And at work, we'd been nominated for some awards, so that was a big thing, and it needed attention. He became unreachable. He just spiralled. There was a load of stuff to be sorted out with the company, and he just didn't do it. He didn't do anything. In the end, they were calling me. He drank a bit, but not much, but he really overate and unhealthily too, which before he had never... and computer games. He got back into computer games and he just didn't get up and go at it. You know, I thought he would have dusted himself off, but he didn't. And it began to occur to me as he sat there getting fatter and smellier and living in a world that was not real, that maybe he wasn't the doer I thought he was. His personal hygiene went. Gone with the suits and the sprucing up, and now he went in completely the other direction and became, oh, disgusting, if I'm honest. And actually, that really confused me. I mean, I kept thinking, is she putting up with this talking, moving, dirty puddle of a man? The plan was to go to him, say I know everything and I want a divorce. And I've been totally honest with you so far, so I'm going to continue and tell you that despite all that had happened, despite what I told myself, despite what I wanted to believe, the divorce was a hope. It was a hope that if he understood what was at stake, he would snap out of everything, and that somewhere in there, buried underneath the self-pity and Haagen-Dazs and stupid, sad little infidelity, was the man I married. The kids were with their gran, my mum, who for once was actually acting like a human being for once. And I got home, had a bath, got ready, and went down and saw him. I want a divorce. No. He hasn't even looked up from his computer game. I heard what you said. He's registering me now, just a bit more. This isn't your choice. Yes, it is. This is my life. These are my kids. This is all still mine. And I'm kind of shocked by this, you know. Mine. You are not leaving. You are never taking my kids from me, understand? You're not being rational. You are never taking my kids. And now he's standing up, facing me, the game abandoned. And it's not aggressive, not physically, but emotionally. Jesus Christ. Emotionally, it is brutal. It is warfare. It is unrestrained genocide. Look. You don't love me anymore. I love you with all my heart. And weirdly, this wasn't a lie. He meant it in some kind of way, I could see that, but rather than a declaration of something wonderful, it was an accusation, kind of indictment, like it was something I was doing to him, something appalling of all the ways I'd played this out. Look, you're not happy. I'm not happy when... Oh, you're not happy? Well, I don't fucking care. I don't fucking care if you're fucking happy. I don't fucking care if you're never fucking happy again. That doesn't fucking matter to me at all. Of all the ways I'd play this out in my head, this was... I want you to listen to me. There will never come a time when you have my kids and I don't. You are not taking them from me as well. That will never happen. I will never let that happen. Do you understand that? As well. As well as what? What was... Okay, fine. I know you're with someone else. Silence. He's saying nothing then. What? I know, all right? I know you've been having an affair, so just stop the lying and listen to me. I know. He's staring at me, shocked. What are you talking about? And... What was strange about his shock was that it was not the shock I'd expected. It was different, more genuine, an unperformable shock. Not the shock of discovery, but rather shock at the notion. What are you talking about? I'm not having an affair. And in that moment, in that exact moment, I realized I'd gotten this all wrong. Totally and completely wrong. Then what is all this? All this? The last year, you, this. And he goes quiet, very quiet, considers, and then he lets me in on the truth. The deep down, dark, secret, brooding truth, he finally drags it up from the depths of his soul and lays it out in front of me like a dissected animal. Don't you have an award speech to prepare or something? And then he goes back to his game. And that is it. I'll get it. I finally get it. I finally get what all this is about, what had been going on with him, the reason he was destroying our life together. Our love. Thing is, you can understand an affair. As much as it hurts like agony, you can actually understand it. But this... this what? Jealousy. This fear that I might outshine, this need for him to be better than me. I thought that the man I loved had changed, but this was so much worse. This was realizing that he had never existed in the first place. In the morning, I went to my mum's, collected the kids, and then went straight to a hotel. I didn't want to stay with friends. I filed for divorce that afternoon and started looking for a flat the next day. Within a week, we were in a new home. Danny, for the first time in his life, noticed something. I don't just mean the fact that we'd moved, but the pain. He noticed the pain, and it really upset him, and he acted out. He was a real little prick, in fact. I bribed him a lot with toys and sweets and trips, but he didn't really calm down until I got him a puppy. He named it Optimus Prime. Leanne, as always, was complicated. I knew she missed her dad, I knew she was hurting, but she went into looking after mode, you know. She kept trying to make me sandwiches. She even started looking after Optimus Prime. And let's face it, if it was left to Danny, the little bugger would have been dead within a week. But she was amazing. She was so amazing. He didn't come around and see them. Not once. I mean, I tried to arrange it. I tried to talk about weekends or whatever, because I wanted them to have contact with their dad. Of course I did, but nothing for 2, 3, 4 months. And it wasn't he was contesting anything, not at all. I mean, he signed all the papers, agreed to everything, but he just melted away. Out of the world we knew, he just, you know, he just... And yeah, part of me thought, that's odd. That is, what's going on with him? Something must be... But then I began to think, oh, okay then. Okay. Are you okay? All right, good. Why don't you come over here and lie down with us? Oh. Well, because I want you to. I'd like you to. Don't you want to? Don't you want to come over here with me? No. Don't worry, you won't wake him. A bomb wouldn't wake him. Right. This is the hard bit. This is the bit that's been coming. And I think maybe you've known it's been coming. But it is here now. And I'm going to say it. I am. But if it gets difficult, and it will get difficult, I want you to remember two things. Remember that this did not happen to you and that it is not happening now. All right? My children were stabbed to death. The knife was a Kandar GX208 hunting knife, especially purchased for that purpose. They're incredibly sharp when first bought. Incredibly sharp. Danny probably didn't know much about it. He was lying on his bed when it happened, so I think he might have thought it was a game or something. There was a slight thumb bruise on his rib cage here.
Just here.
See? Just at the base of the rib start. But it was a very slight bruise, and they say it wouldn't have caused him any noticeable pain, as it would have happened in the exact same moment as the knife went in. So he put his thumb there to find out where the bone ended and the soft, open parts of my son's chest began. Then he put the tip of the knife with the back edge to the nail of his thumb to make sure it went in the right place, to guide it in. Then he pushed with all his weight, twisting it up so that the blade went up behind the ribs and into his own son's heart. I mean, it was well thought out. The wound to the heart was enormous, especially for a heart of that size, leading to a catastrophic loss of blood almost instantaneously. They say that Danny might not have really even registered any pain. It would have been shock, confusion, maybe a sense that something was wrong, but he would have started to black out within 4 or 5 seconds, and within a minute he almost certainly would have been dead. The blood would have been shocking. The sheer amount of it so quick, where only seconds before there were just clean sheets, it would have been like taking a large wooden salad bowl full of blood and pouring it out onto the bed. I think it would have shocked him even as he did it. I will admit to being obsessed with what was going through his mind as he deliberately pushed that knife up into his own son's heart. I will admit to that. They don't know if Leanne was in the room at the same time. This seems not very likely, as it just doesn't feel efficient. What seems more likely is that Leanne came in. I tend to think she was concerned. She was always very smart and perceptive, and I think she would have sensed that something was wrong when he came in. She would have been worried for her little brother. So I think she came in the room and saw it. We know she ran because she was found at the front door, and as he went after her, he left a bloody handmark, a smear on the bedroom doorframe consistent with someone moving at speed. He stabbed her 8 times. In the back of the left shoulder. In the top of the left shoulder near the neck. In the palm of the right hand between the second and third fingers. Twice in her lower right side. In her upper stomach. In her lower chest, right of the heart. In the upper chest, right of her heart. And then he slit her throat just to make sure. They actually don't know what the fatal blow was, but there were several that could have killed her without immediate attention. They are incredibly sharp, those knives. He didn't kill the dog. He did not kill Optimus Prime, which is unusual. Normally they do. Then he took a shower and washed the blood off. But of course he had to put his bloody clothes back on because he had no clothes in that flat. And then there is this 23-minute period where no one really knows what he did, but he was in the flat with the bodies of his kids. That's a long time, 23 minutes. Measure it out. It takes ages. It takes a long time. I have no idea what he did. But at the end of those 23 minutes, he went out onto the balcony, looked down at the concrete road 4 floors below, and threw himself off. And he survived. It's called family annihilation. I know a lot about it now. A lot. A lot of facts. A lot of facts. There's more of it than you think. Much more. It's far more likely for a child to die at the hands of a parent than to be killed by a stranger. Nearly 3 times more likely. It happens every 10 days. We only hear about the really juicy ones, you know. And family annihilation itself is becoming more frequent. It's doubled since the year 2000. It's nearly always men. That's not an opinion or a viewpoint or a controversial statement for you to ponder. It's just a cold hard fact. 95% of the people who do this are men. Sometimes they have a history of violence. There are warning signs that are all too often ignored by the criminal justice system. But actually, the majority of cases, they're completely unknown to the police and the authorities. They don't have records. They're not being watched from the system. They're just dads. It is considered there are 4 types of family annihilator. These are the paranoid, where the perpetrator perceives a threat to the family. The disappointed, where he feels his family's let him down. The self-righteous, really just a kind of revenge on the mother. And the anomic, where he does it for economic reasons or other reasons linked to a shattered self-worth. But you want to know what it's really about. I want to tell you what it's really about. What it's really about is control. It's about losing control. It's about exerting control. It's about denying control to others. I want you to listen to me. There will never come a time when you have my kids and I don't. We often talk about these men as having snapped. In the papers, the news, amongst ourselves, but nothing could be further from the truth. They do not snap, they plan. They know what they're doing. Those 4 months with not a peep out of him. Planning. He had just turned up and convinced the babysitter that he was going to look after them. And of course, for the longest time, that was really a source of fury for me because she could have just fucking called me. But then I realised how much pain she was in and that she was only 17, so I contacted her and told her I understood, even though I didn't. When I saw him going to court, he was broken. I mean, physically, yes, he needed crutches, but actually it was the emotional damage that was most shocking. He was wrecked with sobbing, drowning in tears and pain. I mean, he almost couldn't walk. And I looked at him and I just thought, you're not broken enough. You are not shattered enough. You will never be broken enough. You cannot ever be broken enough for what you did. For what you did. He'd hit a car. He'd landed on the roof of a car and survived like in a joke. You know, like in a sketch comedy. He broke both legs, his arms, nearly all of his ribs, several vertebrae and punctured a lung. He was on life support for 3 weeks. I was in a meeting when they told me. I saw the police outside and I thought it was to do with the guys in the building next door because there'd been this stupid fight 2 days before, just some squabble over parking, but it got quite nasty. These two respectable men in their 50s and suits, you know, squaring up to each other now. But they called me out. And there's these officers, two of them, both men, quite big fellas, 40s, maybe 30s, but seemed older, the uniform perhaps. And the bigger and possibly older of the two came forward to me. And his expression was so gentle, you know, on a big guy. It was, you know, and he says, would you like to sit down? Which is normal enough, but as he does it, he reaches out and gently touches my arm. And that gesture, it's not pre-planned, you see. It's not training or dealing with or managing. It is a rational human response. It just happens. It cannot help it. It's sympathy. But when he does it, something in me shifts. And I know a thing like the shadow of the worst thing in the world has happened. I'm told I attacked him. Which is really strange for me. I've never attacked anyone, but I don't remember. It is honestly a blank for the next few days. I went to see him after to apologise because I felt terrible and he was honestly the sweetest man. He was so generous. He told me not to worry and that response is more common than you might think, which is why they send big blokes like him. Now, I don't know if that's true, but the kindness of him saying that to me, it just blew me away. You know, people are just so... I went through a stage where I thought I could pull back time. If I just tried hard enough. If I just tried, I could pull back time. I mean, I knew I couldn't, I wasn't losing it, but some part of me thought if I just really tried, I could work it out. And I could pull back time. And then I'd go to him and beg him not to, or give him whatever he wanted, or be with him forever, docile, whatever he needed, or kill him. I could have killed him before he did it. You know, I could have... While on remand, he was on permanent suicide watch, and during that time, he reached out to make contact with me 3 times. The first time made me incandescent with rage. I mean, fucking nuclear. The second time made me think, you sad, ridiculous, pathetic thing, just rot. And the third time made me think absolutely nothing at all. Because I'd stopped thinking about him, despite what he wanted. And when they told me that he had killed himself by swallowing the broken end of a plastic spoon and forcing bread into his own gullet, I thought about him then. And then I never thought about him again. Because why? What I do now is I'll carry on. I put one foot in front of the other. I meet other people who've been through the same loss, men and women, and I talk with them, help them, get help from them. And I'm stunned by the courage of these people. I'm overwhelmed by their bravery and their generosity. Their generosity towards life. Because I know that after that, just continuing to draw breath is an act of heroism. And these people, many of them, they continue to love. They continue to live in love. They never forget, but they continue to live in and with love. Optimus Prime is still with me. He's a great comfort when he's not shitting all over the hall. He loves shitting in the hall. One of the surprising losses is the memories, because you have so many that he is in with them. And memories are happy for me. They are a beautiful place, and I cannot have him, that man, that negation of happiness in there. I cannot have him in there with me and my kids. So what I do is I rewrite them. I rewrite those memories, but with him not in them. That's what I do, and it works. Let me tell you, it works, and I think soon I'll have him out of all of them. I think soon it'll be just me and my children. My beautiful children. And then... oh, God, then. Well, that'll be something. It really will. I think a lot about Danny, about what kind of person he would have become, about whether I would have been able to have an effect on certain parts of him, about what kind of man he would have become. I think he would have been a decent man. I do. I really, really do. But you never can tell, can you? Leanne would have been great. Leanne would have been incredible. One thing that keeps coming back to me is what that crazy academic said. The one we're going to do the film on, the society, this incredibly amazing, bizarre, wonderful and complex construction we have made out of human interaction and cooperation has been created for men. To enable men, to empower men, for men to run and tend. I've been thinking a lot about that. And I don't think that's true. You know? I really don't think it is. We didn't create society for men. We created it to stop men. What's that? No, he's sleeping, honey. Yeah, he's sleeping. I don't know. Nice ones, I hope.
The performance is over, but the story continues. Keep listening to go behind the scenes and hear playwright Dennis Kelly talk about Girls and Boys from Audible Studios in London, 2018. This has been an Audible Originals production of Girls and Boys, written by Dennis Kelly, performed by Carey Mulligan, directed by Lindsay Turner. Executive producers Kate Navin and Mike Charzik. Producers Abigail Gonda and Kat Lambrix. Edited by Sarah Kosa. Sound design by David McSeveny. Mixed and mastered by Darren Vermas. Copyright 2018 by AO Media LLC. Sound recording copyright 2018 by AO Media LLC.
I'm Dennis Kelly and I'm the writer of Girls and Boys. Writing Girls and Boys, I think I had three ideas spinning around in my head that I was trying to sort of find a way to talk about. One was that I was interested in writing a monologue, and I was interested in writing a monologue for a woman. And at the same time, I was interested in family and just this sort of minutiae of family. I'd sort of become quite interested in that, but also was, at the same time I was interested in male violence and how women are often the subject of male violence and women suffer male violence. But also within male violence, some men are kind of trapped in that as well, and how a particular type of masculinity, I won't say the phrase toxic masculinity because I'm not sure that's entirely helpful, but I mean, there are particular types of masculinity that men get trapped in and that aren't useful to those men that are trapped in it, you know. So I think it was all of that sort of came together in this play. I was interested in writing a monologue because I like it. I think it's a very direct form of communication. I think I'd actually just written a monologue for a man. I really found that very enjoyable. I like direct address. I love direct address in a theatre. I love it when an actor turns around and looks us in the eye and says something. I think it's very honest and very open. And I think a lot of what we do is about disguising what we feel. And I love with monologues are just straightforward. This is, I'm going to tell you what I think. And it might be rubbish and it might be useless, but I'm going to tell you it anyway because I believe in it, you know. So there's something straightforward and unironic about monologues that I kind of like, you know. So that was one reason. And the other reason was my ex-wife is an actress. She's a very good actress, very talented Italian actress called Monica Napo. And she kept saying, why don't you write me a monologue? And in the end, it was something that got into my head. And I think slowly over a period of years, this thing got into my head. Why don't I write a monologue? So I'm slightly blaming her. Once Carey came aboard, the script changed, but it was by and large the play that you see now. I mean, the first thing that happened, I didn't write the monologue for any theatre. I wasn't under commission. I just wrote it myself because I didn't want to tell anyone about it. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it was going to be. And I just wanted to write it quietly on my own. And then I didn't take it to a theatre, actually. I took it to Lindsay Turner, who directed it. And I'd met Lindsay, and I was really incredibly impressed by her because she's just an incredibly impressive person. But she's also, she's someone who's unbelievably smart, but also is very human as well. Like, she doesn't sort of think that being smart makes her any better than anyone else. And I sort of like that in a person, you know. And so I took the monologue to her, and we sort of talked about it, and she was interested in directing it. But there was a big process of sort of like, you know, I worked with her a bit on the play, and, you know, she'd tell me what she liked and what she didn't like. And, you know, so we'd argue and fight a little bit. I'd sulk and then maybe change it a little bit. And all the process that you normally do with when you're writing stuff, you know. But it was a very healthy process. It was a really good experience, you know. And then we took it to the Royal Court, who said they wanted to do it. And then it was a process of looking for an actor. And we approached Carey, and, you know, luckily she said yes, you know. And it changed a little in rehearsal, not a huge amount, because a lot of that work had been done, but it did change a little in rehearsal and continues to change, you know. And actually, one of the great things about Carey is that she is quite respectful of the script, so she does say all the things you've written, but at the same time there is you know, you can feel it when she's not quite comfortable with something. And, you know, and normally she's right. Normally she's got a really good, you know, she's got a really good eye on what works and what doesn't work. I felt like this play would work well as an audiobook, partly because it's one voice, and I listen to audiobooks quite a bit, and I really enjoy listening to audiobooks. I like the idea that it feels distinct to me. What this is feels distinct from a radio play. This is not a radio play, and it's never was a radio play. It's a play for the stage, you know, and it's hopefully it will translate. I mean, it's difficult because it's probably more visual and physical than it looks, you know. Hopefully we've found ways around that, and that sort of does translate. But I think it's just an interesting idea, taking plays, not radio plays but actual plays, and sort of doing them as audiobooks in a way that we can listen to as well, you know. So we have made some adjustments to the script for this version of it. not as much as I thought we were going to, but there are some moments where she describes things visually on stage, and she's able to sort of point to certain things, and we actually had to sort of change that because you can't hear that. There are just some slight little moments where you can't quite get across what we're able to get across on stage, you know, because you can get it across with a look or a wink, but those moments are really, really small. I mean, by and large, actually, you can get loads across with sound. And You know, we were just recording it today and it just sort of moving around, moving to a different place, moving away from the mic or bending from the mic to sort of pick something up. The sound of someone picking something up while talking is incredibly distinctive. And what's incredible is that our brains are able to process that and go, oh, that's someone bending down and picking something heavy up whilst talking. Our brains are great for this sort of stuff. So actually, you don't lose very much. I mean, I wrote the play 2 years ago. I should probably say that it's 2018 because you might be listening to this. I don't know when you're listening to this, but I wrote the play a good 2 years before it was on. And in the last sort of 4 months before the play was on, the world sort of changed a little bit. And, you know, in regards as to how men were treating women, and we sort of, you know, there was the whole Me Too movement and all of the scandals that sort of suddenly burst onto our front pages. And so the play wasn't designed in any way to speak to any of these things, because it couldn't have been, because it was written before. But in some way, I guess it sort of does. It's, I don't know what the play would have been like had we done it 6 months before. I don't know how it would have been received. I don't know whether it would have been received better or worse. It's very difficult to know whether we're sort of, whether we're actually saying something that feels like it needs to be said, or whether we're saying something that everyone knows now anyway, and people are kind of going, yeah, we get it, dummy, that's really obvious. So it's really hard to tell, but it's, you don't really write with those sorts of things in mind anyway. I mean, you try and write something as honestly as you can about a thing that you think matters. And sometimes it just turns out that, you know, these things, something shifts and we're all talking about that, you know. So it's been a strange time to do it. It's been a really strange time to do it. You know, it's possible looking back at my stuff, and this is not conscious on my part, but I've written some men that are arseholes. Not to put too fine a point on it, I've written some men that are not that great, you know. I don't know why that is. I've also written some women that are not that great as well. I mean, you know, I think you're trying to write across the breadth of what it is to be a person. So, you know, you have to write people that are bad from all angles, you know. But I suppose maybe there is something in me that wants to understand those parts of me and my gender and the bits that are sometimes destructive and corrosive, you know. But also, it's actually, as I think the play sort of puts forward, the thesis that the play puts forward, I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with this, but, you know, it kind of says that men are at the root of a lot of the problems that we have. And I think that might be true. I mean, I don't necessarily want to believe that, because I'm one of them, you know. But it's absolutely true that something like 91% of murders are committed by men. You know, nearly all sexual crimes are committed by men. I mean, there are female murderers, there are female sex offenders, but they are an absolutely tiny number compared to men. The prison population of women is tiny in regards to the prison population of men in all countries. You know, so men are at the root of a lot of that stuff that we as a species are getting wrong. And I suppose that's probably why I'm writing those male figures, because it's those male figures that are doing that, you know. But as I say, it's not conscious. It's sort of, it's unconscious, you know. I mean, for me, I suppose I never see my work as dark, but I've been told that it is. So I have to accept that that might be the truth. I don't think I write bad people. I think I write people who are failing to be good. I don't know why I do it. And I have in later years attempted not to do it. And it always comes out, something bad always happens. I don't mean it to. But my feeling on it is, I don't know, I'm just trying to represent the world. The things that happen in this play happen, and they happen a lot. And they happen time and time again. And I make no apologies for sort of going into those areas, because it is happening, you know. We don't live in a sort of nice, wonderful, fluffy world that we like to pretend, you know. We're all jealous of our friends, you know. I mean, we live in this strange world where we can love someone and hate someone at exactly the same time, you know. So I think it's good to sort of show the complexity of a species, you know. I've never seen plays as things that need to answer questions, and in fact I find that kind of frustrating, actually. I think often what happens in a play is an idea is put forward, a question is asked, and then the play answers it. And I find that really annoying because it doesn't involve me at all. Like, I'm much more interested in writing things that where I don't know the answer rather than where I can come along and say, you know, this is what we should all be doing. You know, if we just do what I think, everything will be fine. Well, it's not true. I haven't got a clue. I'm just an idiot like everyone else, you know. And so I feel like I'm much more attracted to things where I don't fully know the answer. I mean, Girls and Boys doesn't sort of say, if we do this, then this will be fine, because I don't have a clue what we do, you know. But I think by talking about these things and by sort of, I think what you're doing as a writer, hopefully, is you're trying to contribute to a conversation, you know, and maybe if you're lucky, smarter people than you will come along and come up with the answer, but you've got to keep talking about it, you know. One of the places where the play started was I thought for a while that, you know, I mean, this is sort of in the play, in the where the academic, when the academic speaks, but, you know, he sort of says, you know, any objective look at our species would have to conclude that, you know, violence and bloodshed was part of that, and that is by and large done by males, you know. And you know, I think that it's true, you know, you can't look at our species and think that things like, I mean, it's so baked into who we have been ever since we have been modern humans. I mean, some of the earliest grave sites we've seen, you know, you dig them up and you find that those people were killed with blunt trauma, you know, and we've been murdering for a long, long time, and most other species don't murder. Very, very, very few species murder. It's a very unusual thing to do. You know, there are spiders that eat the male, but that's part of that's a useful thing to do, you know. And you can argue that murder is actually a useful thing to do. And you know, I would argue that it is, you know, in evolutionary terms, we've grown up murdering and bloodshed and torture and all of these things. They've sort of bonded us as a society, and they've against the other, you know, the other country or the other tribe or whoever it was, and they united us. So there might be an evolutionary advantage to that. I couldn't possibly say, but it seems to me that there might be. But if there is, then it's something that's baked into who we are as a species, you know. And that all sounds really, really grim. I think it isn't, because I think on the one hand we have that, and then on the other hand we have this brilliant thing called society that we created, and that stops us doing that, and is stopping those things happening, you know. So I don't know, I think there's real reason for optimism with the human race. If we can just sort of keep ourselves together a little bit, stop killing each other for 5 minutes, we'd be golden. But I think the academic's viewpoint is that all of these difficulties are kind of really because men are quite bad at being in power, you know. And I think that's not an unfair argument. I think men are not great at being in power, and I've thought that for a long time. And I've thought, you know, if we were to be smart about it, we would probably say, let's make it a little bit harder for men to gain power because they're not good at it, you know. I don't know how you do that, and I think that's, and you know, as a kind of a, you know, a Guardian reading liberal, I think it's that you can't do that, and it's wrong. It's wrong to sort of discriminate on people because of their gender. So, of course, you can't do that, but it's just a sort of a thought riff, you know. If you're listening to this before you've listened to the play, then stop listening now, because this is a spoiler. So, a spoiler alert, I've never said that before. So the last few lines of her monologues, and this is coming from a woman who has lost her children at the hands of a man. She's talking about the academic's view that society was made to enable men, to empower men, for men to run and for men to tend. And then she says, and I don't think that's true, you know. I really don't think it is. We didn't create society for men. We created it to stop men. So it's quite a challenging idea. And I've been challenged on this a lot. And I don't literally think that we created society to stop men. But I think in some ways we did. Like, I think if we look at society as something that prevents the darker parts of us, you know, a successful society kind of prevents the darker parts of us from being expressed. You know, most of those darker parts are from my gender, you know, like I say, you know, the amount of murders, the amount of assaults, they tend to be from men. So, and society is about a lot of other things as well. It's not just about that, of course. But if we do think that society is there to protect us, and I mean, most of that protection is from ourselves, then I sort of do stand by that statement, so that society is made to stop men. I think it's a It's a difficult statement, and I've had some people that have not been very happy with the statement, and I understand that as well. And I've had some men say that, you know, it's unfair, and it's unfair to use a child killer to categorise men. And I think that's absolutely true, but I think enough men are violent for the statement men are violent to be true. And so I kind of stand by that. I'm not a violent man. I've not been violent, but I think I'm not a violent man mainly because I'm not really good at it. And like, if I was, had I been good at violence as a younger man, I think maybe I would have been a violent person, you know. And there's probably in me, there's probably as a younger person, not now, not that I'm old and knackered, but as a younger man, there was probably you know, someone that would have been interested in killing someone or would have been interested in violence, you know. But I think that's not unusual. I think men have that. We grow up with little toys where we're sort of shooting each other in the face, and you know, we're just interested in it, we just like it, we're just, there's something about it that we like, you know. And I think we can't deny that about ourselves. I mean, but there's also, you know, there's other sides of being a man that are incredibly, that are great as well. There's fatherhood, you know, and there's all of those sorts of things that are also very male, you know. And it's not about just saying men are bad, aren't we awful, let's lock us all up. It's maybe about sort of saying, let's sort of re-look at what we kind of consider to be important in our masculinity, you know.
We hope you enjoyed listening to Girls and Boys. If you are interested in hearing more Audible theater programs, be sure to check out Harry Clark, written by David Cale and performed by Billy Crudup.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.